The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott.
Can we find a leader now who can beat Jeremy Corbyn and deliver a sensible Brexit that fights off the threat from the insurgent Brexit Party? And I have to say that that is the job that I believe I'm best suited to do today.
Boris Johnson came out of hiding yesterday to finally launch his bid to be the next Prime Minister. As the field of candidates narrows and polls show him way out in front, can anything derail the Boris Express? Also this week, we'll be looking at whether any of the contenders' promises on Brexit, tax cuts and the economy actually stack up. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. It was standing room only at the launch of Boris Johnson's leadership bid yesterday, with hard Brexiters and Conservative rising stars all there to show support, with maybe an eye on the job in the next cabinet. At the time of recording, we don't know who has and who hasn't got the 16 votes needed to stay on the list of contenders, but we can probably assume that Johnson, Dominic Raab, Jeremy Hunt, Michael Gove, Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock are all on there. At the moment, the contest is Boris's to lose, but is he really the best man for the job? Are any of them? Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Isabel Hardman from The Spectator, Jonathan List from British Influence and Polly Toynbee from The Guardian. Isabel, how do you think the Boris launch went yesterday? Did he sort of emerge unscathed? Was it sufficiently boring enough?
Well, that was certainly their aim, was to make it dull, safety first, which is really the theme of Boris Johnson's campaign. When he's allowed out to speak, the aim is basically to try to make him look a bit more of a serious politician. And so in terms of his speech and in terms of, I think, the way he answered the questions or didn't answer them in a lot of cases, I think his team would have been quite pleased with that. There was one thing that overshadowed it a bit, I think, which was that some MPs actually heckled a journalist for asking Johnson a very reasonable question about his comments about mocking women who wear burqas. And it's often the case that activists from parties get annoyed with journalists for asking their dear leader inconvenient questions, but it's still quite unusual for MPs to do that. And that's
a bad look as well for a candidate.
It's a very bad look for a candidate. It makes them look defensive, as though they've got something to hide. And what I thought made it worse was that Liz Truss, one of Boris Johnson's supporters, then went on TV to defend her colleagues' heckling, saying that they were entitled to question the questions of journalists, which I think it would have been much easier just to say, I think some of my colleagues got overexcited here and yeah, Boris can answer for himself.
Part of the idea of Boris being PM might have been laughed at a few months ago. And I think that probably we thought that his colleagues had lost trust in him. Tory MPs had lost trust in him, particularly in his performance as Foreign Secretary. Why are they rallying behind him now?
This has been quite extraordinary. It's the Conservative Party completely losing any sense of responsibility for the fate of the nation. The party that used to be the solid, the reliable, the party of government has become wild, reckless, revolutionary, because they think he is the only person who might squeak past in a general election and save them from both Farage and from Corbyn, and save their seats and save their party. He might, on the other hand, be the final explosive device that blows the whole thing apart. It might be that he is so appalling that if he really does take us out of Europe on a no deal, that the Conservative Party makes itself unelectable forever afterwards because of the self-inflicted chaos caused. But they reckon that as things stand, he might save them their seats. It's a very low reason for choosing him.
Jonathan, he seems to have been concentrating quite a lot on just securing the backing of MPs. He's not announcing anything, you know, particularly controversial. Only two things, I think, a tax cut and also that he would leave by October the 31st. Is just him kind of keeping things very simple his best route to success?
It certainly seems so at the moment. If you are the kind of the pole position candidate, you obviously don't want to have any controversy, and Johnson is famous for that. And so he's just letting the ship go on, if you like. I mean, Theresa May did a similar thing in a way in 2016 when she just watched everyone else self-combust and she was the last person standing. But the problem for Johnson is that he's told the truth extraordinarily when he said that the Tories faced extinction if they didn't deliver Brexit by the 31st of October. There is no way on earth that they can deliver Brexit by the 31st of October. There are a couple of weeks of parliamentary time after the summer recess, where nothing can be done. Certainly there can be no more renegotiation and no legislation. And so he's already made a rod for his own back, that the first thing he'll have to do as Prime Minister is go to the EU and ask to stay in it. So already the trust will be smashed. And I can't understand why the Tories don't understand that. And conversely, if he did try to get to that no deal, as Polly said, if you actually went over the cliff, and then Boris Johnson would never be forgiven for that, and the Tories wouldn't either. And then Parliament would probably humiliate him and try to stop it anyway. So there's really no way through for him that he can emerge from this with any kind of credibility whatsoever.
Well, some of the other candidates have sort of tried to gain a bit of credibility, people like Jeremy Hunt and Matt Hancock, by saying, you know, actually, it's very difficult to leave with no deal, deal or no deal by October 31st, because, as Jonathan's laid out, you know, it's difficult to negotiate anything new in that time. And also because Parliament is likely to stop a no deal Brexit. Do any of those candidates have any chance of beating him when it comes to the runoff? Thinking of people like Jeremy Hunt or Sajid Javid, Michael Gove.
Jeremy Hunt or Sajid Javid or Michael Gove, the most likely. Matt Hancock, who you mentioned, is probably going to get knocked out either in this round or the next one, because he just doesn't have enough of a constituency within the Conservative Party. And his pitch, I went to his launch on Monday, his pitch was slightly crazed, I have to say.
David Brent.
Yeah, it was a bit difficult to sort of pin down what he believed other than motivational aphorisms. I felt a bit like I was at a spinning class rather than a Tory leadership launch. But for the others, they are trying to sort of offer a bit more of a realistic Brexit plan. And that's tricky in the current Tory party, because the mood in the party is not really one for any further delay. They're still reacting to the procrastination of Theresa May, and perhaps not looking at the situation that she's left the party in and trying to work out the best way out of that. They just don't want anyone who's going to put it off anymore. And that's why Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab were the only two candidates who even got auditions before the European Research Group, which is the most Brexity group in the Conservative Party and has a huge amount of power, not just in the parliamentary party, but also, I think, amongst the Conservative membership. So it's tricky, because I think there is a Brexit purity contest going on at the moment that doesn't bear a great deal of relation to reality.
Of those, Polly, of Michael Gove, Sajid Javid, Jeremy Hunt, who do you see as having the most likelihood of beating Johnson?
Well, I suppose it would be Gove, if he can recover from the cocaine hypocrisy.
Which
he's
really sunk him quite a lot,
after all,
hasn't it?
Astonishing. But maybe he can be forgiven, in which case he's much the strongest contender. He knows Boris back to front. If he really decides to put the knife in again, as he did last time, he could be very effective.
When one of the candidates we're not really talking about at all anymore, which was quite strange, is Dominic Raab, who did, you know, sort of was seen as maybe he could be the true Brexiteer candidate when Boris, you know, had folded earlier than him and said he was going to vote for Theresa May's deal. But he's lost all of that ERG support to Boris. Why do you think that is, Jonathan?
I think that the ERG saw the winner. And if Johnson is going to match Raab pound for pound in Brexit, then there was no reason to back Raab, who is a much less sympathetic, charming character, who has question marks over his personal character, which haven't quite been addressed, and who is has a kind of 80s Tory boy thing going on about him a bit, which is going to not be a particular turn on to the Tory party, or certainly not to the wider electorate. So that's so Boris Johnson sort of nabbed all the spaces, really.
I think Raab is also tainted because he didn't leave the cabinet, obviously, after the Chequers agreement. That was Boris who did that, and Boris Johnson is therefore able to claim that he is more Brexit pure. So we come back to this incredible sort of holy Brexit contest that's going on.
But Johnson survived the backstop. No one's talking about the backstop anymore. In December 2017, Theresa May signed us up to a customs union.
And
people
he
didn't
it
admit
great,
that
great,
at the time, but Boris Johnson, he knew what it was. And then afterwards, extraordinarily, when he left the cabinet, he said he didn't know what it was. So he was basically saying that he was either gullible or stupid or a liar. And it didn't seem to matter, because he's Teflon.
It's fascinating how there's actually a higher bar for the behaviour of all the other candidates apart from Boris Johnson. And it's something his team say the whole time, that, oh, his personal life is priced in. It's almost as though he could actually have killed people and that would also be priced
in. Just like Trump said about shooting someone on Fifth Avenue.
Two of the front runners who have said that they are the two, well, I suppose if we still count Dominic Raab amongst the front runners, that they've said that we'd be prepared to take the UK out of the EU with no deal, and that on October 31st, Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, the others have sort of said that they think it's possible that Parliament would be able to stop that. But we saw yesterday there was an opportunity for Parliament to set that in motion, for there to be to at least reserve another date to try and pass a law to stop it. Isabel, some people listening, and probably anyone who's not been following this with the minute detail of a full-time job, are going to find it quite odd to hear that it was defeated last night. It feels like Parliament's voted against no deal quite a few times. And maybe you could explain to us a little bit about what happened last night.
Yes, so there were some interesting dynamics going on last night. You had a group of Conservative MPs who voted with Labour on this vote, which was to allow Parliament to rule out no deal in a future vote, just to complicate and confuse matters even further. But then you had a group of Labour MPs who voted with the government, people like Kate Hoey, who obviously managed to enrage their party on a regular basis with their Brexit views. And you also had a number of abstentions as well. And so this has turned the Labour Party in on itself again, with the very pro-Remain, pro-second referendum, anti-no deal MPs like Ben Bradshaw, for instance, turning on their colleagues and saying how much they've let the party down. So we've got another Labour split here.
Is this a big boost to those candidates who believe that Parliament actually won't stop no deal?
I suppose it is. If there is a mechanism for stopping it, it isn't clear what that mechanism could be.
Jonathan, obviously people like Oliver Letwin have been out this morning, the Tory MP and the former Tory MP Nick Bowles, saying that this was the last chance. There are no more assigned opposition day debates, which the government has to grant, but it's in their power to grant Labour time to have debates on things where they want. But those days have now run out, and there's also no obvious legislation going through Parliament for amendments to be added to that could stop no deal. What is the route apart from a confidence vote?
Well, that is obviously the nuclear button of the confidence vote. But I think that we need to look at John Bercow here. Bercow has cast himself as some kind of maverick revolutionary when it suits him, and he is prepared to cast aside conventions and rewrite the rulebook. I mean, I'm not an expert in sort of parliamentary etiquette and protocol, so I don't know exactly how much power he has, but it seems that he can sort of rewrite Erskine May sort of as he goes along. So if he decides, if Parliament has a will to introduce legislation very quickly, as Yvette Cooper did earlier this year, and they are given an opportunity to vote for that, then I just can't see any way in which Bercow will say, no, the procedure says
but
you can't.
But unfortunately, what happened last night is that Parliament decided not to. They had the opportunity.
Right.
It'll make it very difficult, I think, for Bercow to devise anything. Also, you're asking him to do something way out of anything he's done so far. I think we're going to end up with whether there will be enough Conservative MPs willing to bring the House down, willing to have a vote of no confidence in who will presumably be Boris MP, PM, and call for a general election. And I just don't know, when it comes to it, whether the likes of people who are very anti-Brexit, whether they'll really get air go that far. What do you think, Isabel? Do you think there are enough of them to actually break their own party?
They would lose the whip, wouldn't they? That would be, if you vote against your government in the no confidence vote, you lose the Tory whip.
Yeah, I think that is your way, basically, of saying, I've had it with the Conservative Party. And, you know, who knows, that things are quite febrile at the moment, although there is less of a thirst for leaving parties, given what's happened to Change UK, because I think that's shown how difficult it is to go it alone from a big structure that's been rumbling along for many decades, like Labour or the Tories.
I suppose we also have to see what happens over the course of the leadership contest. If Boris Johnson has hardened his position over the summer to try and win over that very hard Brexit electorate, and it comes, Parliament is still sitting at the end of July when he is elected, then that could be the moment where his colleagues such as Dominic Grieve, Justine Greening maybe say, enough is enough, you're going to take us out on the 31st of October, we're not having it. And then you trigger that election when there's still time to stop no deal 3 months later.
But they will not be allowed to stand as Conservative.
Yeah. I mean, Dominic Grieve, I think he knows his career is over.
They will all
anyway,
lose their seats. Are there enough of them willing to sacrifice their careers for the sake of the country? And that's what it'll come to. And possibly there are enough noble-minded people willing to do that.
I mean, I guess one of the things that we haven't touched on is whether it is possible for any of these candidates to get any kind of new deal by October 31st. I mean, we're all sort of laughing about that. But if it comes to the crunch, do you think that there are people who maybe didn't believe Theresa May was prepared to take us out with no deal, but may believe that someone like Boris Johnson is.
Well, this is the line that the sort of the Boris-style candidates often use, is that the European Union is saying, oh, they're not going to reopen the withdrawal agreement, they're not going to you know, start renegotiating in any way. They say, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? That's their kind of, you know, their starting line in the negotiations. And perhaps that is the stance of the European Union that will then fold when suddenly this new powerful conservative leader comes in. But even the leadership candidates who claim they're trying to be more realistic, like Jeremy Hunt, for instance, are still saying that they want to reopen the withdrawal agreement. So all of them are promising something that, according to what has been said so far, is not realistic.
How will it look from Europe?
The EU is tired of these games. It's actually written into the extension that you can't renegotiate the withdrawal agreement. So that is put, so the backstop isn't changing. The only thing that you might be able to do, and this is a push, is to renegotiate the political declaration, which isn't going to be enough because it has no legal weight. But more importantly, there are only two things you can do with the political declaration. The first is to soften it. So you explicitly ask to negotiate a customs union and a single market, which is obviously not help any of the Tories, or you harden it in that you pare down the backstop just to Northern Ireland, and that cleaves the Conservative and Unionist Party in one clean slice. So there's nothing that they can do which will help them at all, and the backstop is simply not up for negotiation. It's not in the EU's political interest to sacrifice its leverage for a Prime Minister who hates them, and the feeling is quite mutual.
Thanks, Saul. We'll be back after this.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Now, not content with doing their best to out-Brexit one another, the Tory leadership rivals have been seeking to pick up votes by announcing a series of increasingly unlikely tax cuts. Never mind that public services are struggling to cope after a decade of austerity, the candidates' tax cuts would cost more than £60 billion a year between them. We're joined by The Guardian's economics correspondent Richard Partington to tell us how and if any of these ideas stack up. So first up, Boris Johnson, he wants to raise the higher rate income tax threshold to £80,000 from £50,000. What would that cost?
Well, it feels absolutely tone deaf, really. I mean, and it's an absolute gift for Labour strategicians, because they're going to be looking now, if there was to be an election in the autumn between Labour and the Conservatives, that this is a gift for the headline writers. This looks like the Conservatives promising tax cuts for the rich. In terms of the cost to the Treasury, it'd be about £10 billion. After, you know, a decade of austerity, public services are squeezed, and your immediate spending priority is to give £10 billion away to higher earners. It doesn't really feel as though it makes much political sense. The Resolution Foundation did some analysis and found that about 80% of the highest earning households would be the ones that would benefit most from this type of a tax cut. So it feels quite a strange moment to come out with that as your leading message.
Why do you think he's done it? Who will it resonate with? I think we know the answer.
Potentially with Conservatives. I mean, that's who they're appealing to in this contest, after all, the electorate that would pick the new leader. Perhaps this is the type of red meat that Conservatives like to hear from their leaders, that is lower taxes, aspirational taxes. It's quite interesting, though. I read something the other day saying that Conservative electorate, you know, the Conservative Party members, not even all of them would benefit from this type of a tax break. For, you know, 50,000, raising the threshold to 80,000, that's, you know, the top 3 million of earners, and we have a workforce of about 32.5 million. It's really the quite top end. The average wage is in the country about £26,000. So it's more of a sort of offer to the aspirational Conservatives, who feel this is something that everybody could achieve.
Yeah, that's what one, some of his team will say. They'll say that something like £50,000, or some of the lowest earners might one day aspire to earn something like £50,000, whereas £80,000 just seems you know, way beyond. That's the real wealthy. You know, did the statistics bear that out?
Well, as I was saying, I think that the, you know, this is the top 3 million of earners in the country, and you know, Labour stands in contrast to this in saying that they would keep taxes steady for about 95% of the population, and that's up to an £80,000 threshold. And therefore, you know, in a straight fight between the Conservatives and Labour, you know, this is a message that you would think that the majority of the public would back. But sometimes people feel as though that they could reach that bracket one day, and therefore they like to have that type of opportunity open to them in future and believe that they deserve that type of reward should they have worked hard enough. But it's a difficult sell, I would have thought, in this current climate. And the polling is sort of showing us that the public are increasingly in favour of higher taxes if it means greater spending on public services. After, you know, a decade of austerity, we've got this element of fatigue. And the feeling really should be that taxes are going in a higher direction in future, really.
Talking about tax cuts for the wealthy, we've got the former Deutsche Bank employee Sajid Javid, who famously, I think, took a 95% pay cut to become an MP. He wants to scrap the 45% tax band on incomes above 150,000. Is that, I mean, presumably that sort of puts in a similar place. What does that cost?
Absolutely. I mean, that's another large tax break. I haven't got the figure in front of me just at the moment, but it's a, you know, part of that cumulative £60 billion that was offered between Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, Sajid Javid, and Michael Gove for their various pledges. It was a strange tax commitment to be making again at this time. Sajid Javid said that he is a low tax kind of person. Again, this is appealing to the Conservative base. I think he also said that there would be tax cuts for those on lower incomes as well. But it's sort of a strange message to say that this is the right moment for reducing taxes. I think George Osborne used to make an argument that tax cuts at the very top rate for the additional rate of income, when it was 50% put up there by Alistair Darling after the financial crisis, when Osborne reduced it to 45%, he said that that would actually gain more income for the exchequer because people would, you know, more likely to pay their taxes. What the evidence showed was that there was an increase in income of about £8 billion, but it was from people deferring their tax payments to take advantage of the cut. It wasn't as though there was a magical sudden increase in the amount of activity at the top end of the economy that brought in this additional income.
The other sort of two big ideas that I wanted to talk about, Michael Gove's, is to replace VAT, which I think is quite a popular tax, VAT, with a kind of sort of simpler, lower US-style sales tax. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What would that do, and how much would it cost?
Well, for starters, if you're campaigning on a policy that sounds as wonkish as scrapping VAT, you're not really in the right sort of place, are you? I mean, this is sort of looking at an incredibly nerdy proposition to remove VAT and replace it with a US-style sales tax. I think there's 160 economies around the world that actually use the VAT system. The reason why the United States doesn't is that taxes are set on a state level. It's incredibly complicated to have a VAT system across all of those states. But in the UK, again, it would cost billions of pounds to change such a system, throw the revenue service into disarray as they try and come to terms with making these adjustments. There are some devils in this detail as well, in that VAT has elements that mean it doesn't apply to certain goods such as food, clothes for children. And with a sales tax, there could be a concern that the tax is levied across the board. If he's talking about a simple sales tax, you would imagine that for it to work, it would need to apply to everything. And that could be very unpopular with voters if they were to see the prices of food and children's clothes rising as a consequence.
The other one who's made a big tax pledge is Jeremy Hunt, slashing corporation tax from 19% to 12.5%. He wants it to be one of the lowest in developed countries. What do we make of that? Again, it doesn't feel like it chimes with the current political climate, and maybe I'm getting it all wrong, but what would be the reasoning behind that?
Well, it seems a strange one. I suppose the argument that you could make, potentially, to play devil's advocate, is that after a hard Brexit, if Jeremy Hunt was to, you know, redouble his Brexiter credentials, not that he had them to begin with, but if he was to try and posture about hard Brexit, he could say that I would stimulate the economy by cutting corporation tax down to the levels used in Ireland, which are amongst the lowest in the world. I mean, besides tax tax havens in the Caribbean. The tax rate in Ireland at 12.5% is the lowest in advanced economies. To do that, you know, he would hope that companies would invest more money, pay their workers higher wages, and increase their activity levels in the UK, choose to operate in the UK in the event of a no-deal Brexit. However, you know, the UK already has one of the lowest corporation tax rates in the OECD. It's at 19%, set to drop down to 17% under the Conservatives' plans. It was 28% when Labour left office in 2010. But over that time period, the tax receipts have increased, but the economy has strengthened. But what we're really looking for from corporation tax cuts is greater levels of business investment in the UK economy. Business investment in the UK lags behind other major countries, and we have this thing called the productivity puzzle in the country, where the technology gains that should deliver greater increases in efficiency in the workforce and the economy have not come over the past decade. People's wages are still below where they were before the financial crisis as well. So on both those fronts, the tax cuts for businesses appear not to really have delivered the supposed gains that we would want to see from them.
Polly, we're told that austerity is over, and it certainly seems to be if we're making all these sort of big spending and tax cut promises. But do you think any of these are really going to chime with the electorate?
I think they're an absolute gift to the Labour Party. If we're going to have an election this year, which we might well, all of these will come back to haunt them. And even if they decide that's not what they really want to do, their instincts are always for cutting tax for the better off. And even when they pretend to produce cuts that look as if they're for the lower paid, when they raised the tax threshold at the bottom, it was shown time and time again that nearly all of the benefit went to people in the top half of earnings. So sometimes even things that look as if they're going to help the poor don't. People know where the Conservatives' heart is, and these tax cuts certainly show it. I think it's extraordinary how tinier they've become. But then they are away with the fairies on almost every level, on almost every subject. And when people talk about the end of austerity, they think more money for public services. They don't think more tax cuts for the rich.
And also, a lot of this seems to be, I mean, at least I think it's Boris Johnson who said that they want to use Philip Hammond's fiscal headroom, as he's put it, which some of us thought might be needed for other economic events that may or may not happen over the next year or so. Does it feel strange to be talking about this when, Jonathan, when it's, when we may be heading for a no-deal Brexit, which could really make huge difference to the economy?
Absolutely. We're through the looking glass. We are having a conversation which we would have had at any time in the last 40 years about tax and spend, Conservatives being low tax, austerity in the last, for 10 years or so, when we're standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon and we don't know if or when we're going to fall off the edge of it. So it's quite surreal. Of course, we need to explore this. But as Polly says, everything the Conservative Party is doing is deluded right now. The raison d'etre of the party is to make us all poorer in potentially a quite obscene way. And so it's almost kind of comical to take them seriously in some other area of the economy when Brexit is going to change and transform our economic life for generations.
Richard, is that right? Is it difficult to kind of try and make these pledges when we just don't know what state the Treasury might be in a year's time?
Absolutely. I mean, Philip Hammond, is the voice of reason in this conversation, which is quite strange sometimes. But he's saying things as though, you don't know what you're facing. So how can you make these tax cuts in this moment in time where you don't know how the economy is going to perform? If you've got a no-deal Brexit, Bank of England warns that we could have an immediate recession worse than the financial crisis. I mean, that's going to damage the public finances no end. And I'm not sure how you can promise to increase the tax threshold for the higher earners without saying how you're going to fund that type of a pledge in such an environment.
Okay, thanks everyone. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Isabel Hardman, Jonathan Liss, Richard Partington and Polly Toynbee. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.